This morning, in the Creekside Room, Bill Malcolmson will be teaching a session on creative aging. This one is entitled Mortality. So let's listen in on Bill.
When the person who was making announcements was going over the what was happening this morning, she came to the point where she announced the creative aging, and then the topic was mortality, and then there was this short pause, and she says, "Is anyone departing today?" Which, that's the sort of thing I would sometimes say in the middle of a sermon and wonder why they were laughing. Anyway, I hope that it's not the case that any of you, or myself for that matter, are departing today. Rather, wait a while. I did want to say something about this book. There are three of these in the bookstore. Two reasons for that. One reason is that I probably should have, I discovered today after talking with the bookstore manager, that I should have sent my request in a little earlier. That would have helped. Well, there it is. Second reason is that they're just slow in getting stuff here. Having come to Holden Village, now I can understand why that might be the case. But this is a very good book, I think. Kathleen Fisher is got her doctorate at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, where I used to teach. And she teaches now at Seattle University, which is a Jesuit school in Seattle, where I also have some connections with. Anyway, it's put by Paulist Press, but it's not a Catholic book in the sense of it's, you have to be a Catholic to know what they're talking about. But it's a Catholic in the universal sense would be all right, I suppose. The subtitle is Spirituality for the Later Years, and it's a very good book. There are three copies in the bookstore, which you're welcome to buy. There are also, I noticed in the bookstore, some other books on aging which are quite interesting, particularly on women's aging. There's a beautiful book of photographs there of older women, and each of the pages says something about the person. I've been through that book, and it's just absolutely fascinating. And the one on When I Get Old, I Shall Wear Purple is a good... there we are. Well, when you get old, you can wear it again.
How it fits now.
Right. And there are, good point, you know. And there are some other books in there that are sort of two sections on aging, one particular on women's aging. I didn't see anything on men's aging. I don't know if this is discrimination.
They don't,
that's right. They die earlier, which I've always felt was a unfortunate fact. I've never quite figured it out. But on the other hand, I've never quite wanted to figure it out. So today we're going to deal with the matter of mortality, and we are all aware that we're terminally ill, that we will all die, that even whatever we happen to think of life after death, and there are a variety of views of life after death, even among Christians, we still face death. We still have to deal with mortality. We still do die, after all. And those who are near to us and dear to us die, often way too prematurely. Though we may be immortal, we are also mortal. And we know that we're in the process of dying over a period of time. We're in the process of losing over a period of time. Losing time, losing friends. The old saying about, I looked in the obits this morning to see if I'm still here. In fact, of course, that's not so funny, not because that's why I look, but because I find myself, I do look in the obits to see if somebody I know, you know, didn't make it through last night. And it seems to me that people my age are dying far too fast. I don't know if you do what I do, but I look, when I look in the obits, I'll look there and see, now what age were these folks? You do that? Good, I'm not the only one. And if they, and if it's anything past 85, I say, well, that's probably, that's okay. Now, I think as I get to be closer to 85, I'll say anything past 95, you know, that's probably all right. Jessica Tandy died a couple days ago, and she was 85 years old, and I thought, that's not old. Why did she die at 85? Hume Cronin's still around. You know.
Who was the famous man that just said, old age is always 5 years older than I am?
Good one. Right. Anyway, our system becomes more susceptible to deterioration rather than regeneration. I don't know how many more times I have to listen to the thing about, well, you know, if you're younger, you recuperate faster. That's not just. If you're older, you should recuperate faster because your system should get used to recuperating, you see, and, you know, it should have experience in recuperating so that you can recuperate faster when you're older, and when you're younger, who cares? You know, you have time to recuperate. You don't want to go to school anyway, but now at our age, you don't go to school, so you have to just recuperate for way too long. We tend to be more open to disease when we get older, so they tell us. I'm not sure that's altogether true. I think in some ways we're a lot more cautious and more careful about disease. I wanted to divide this discussion of mortality into three different areas: time, health and illness, and life after death. And I'm going to be using some of these quotations. Now, some of you, it's hard to believe, but some of you who were here yesterday may not have brought this with you. And if that's the case, I'm very thoughtful. I kept a few extra copies because I know that there are times in my life when I've been guilty of not bringing stuff with me that I once had. Alice, you get the A for today because you brought your C. Yes. There are still people. Are you in the memory course?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, I think so.
Next question, what's that?
Yeah, right. I think I am. I have to check.
Where did you say Fisher is teaching?
Seattle University.
That's a Jesuit school?
It's a Jesuit school, yeah. Okay, let's take a look at this matter of time. I want to turn to the quotation from Catherine Fisher. You see it here, some relevant quotations from Winter Grace. Let me just read this part. During much of our life, we measure time by its duration. How many hours there are left in a day? How many days until a birthday, a holiday, a longed for or dreaded event? How many years have passed? How many remain before us? We rush through one task in order to hasten on to the next. But as we reach late life, this preoccupation with quantity gives place to an appreciation of the quality of our time. Each moment, each day, each year becomes more precious. We're finally able to sink into the present moment. I'm not sure I like that particular image. Sink into the present moment. And to appreciate the ordinary things around us, to experience the depth of time as well as its duration. Or is it the next to quote the phrase, resting in the real, which I thought was an interesting kind of image also. Now, if we were to look at time as quantitative, that means You know, it's now 12, and 2 minutes from now it will be, all things being equal, it will be 12:02. And so that would be looking at time quantitatively. Or, to be a little more personal, again, I don't think I'm the only one in the world who's ever done this, but I think now I'm 62 years old. And let's say I live until I'm 85. That means I have 23 years to go. Then I think 23 years ago, you know, before this, I'm trying to think, what's 23 years? So 23 years before this, I was 39. And then I think about, now, how have those years gone? Let's see now, did those go fast? Did those go slow? Were those meaningful? And I think, well, now I've got that amount of time. That's looking at time quantitatively. Am I the only one in the world who's ever done that? None of you, have you ever? No, you've never done that? It's amazing.
And now you're going to go out to 21st
century. 21st century, that's the year 2000, yeah. I think throughout a good deal of our lives, that is the way we tend to look at time. How much time have I got left? Well, I have to get to such and such place, or, you know, right? I mean, that's quantitative time. Or our daughter, for example, we were on vacation, she and I were on vacation at Glacier Park a couple months ago, and I know that since she was on vacation, and since I'm retired, I'm always on vacation, but she was on vacation, and she had X amount of days, you know, the company had allowed her to have her vacation. So I know that she was doing this. She wouldn't admit it because she liked to think about it, but I know she was doing this. That when she'd get to the middle of the time, she'd think, well, now I have, you know, so-and-so days left. I'm halfway through my vacation, and now that's quantitative way of looking at time. Then there's also qualitative way of looking at time. To use the analogy again with when Christy and I went to Glacier Park, I know that the rains were coming, and they weren't very heavy, but they were coming, and fortunately the trees around our tent were pretty thick, and so you could sit in a room and just get a little sprinkle. So I was sitting there really enjoying this, I mean, really taking it all in. I like rain in the lake, particularly if it's kind of misty and not just like this. And I was sitting there and meditating, I guess you'd say meditating. That's really calling it something a little more grandiose than it was, but I was sitting there communing with, yes, thinking, blanking out. And I know that Christy was out there walking around because she wanted to see something, and so she wanted to make sure she saw it, you know, because she's kind of figured that's what I'm going to do this afternoon. And I thought, you know, there's nothing I have to do this afternoon, or tomorrow for that matter. So I was experiencing qualitative time. Well, she was really experiencing quantitative time. That doesn't mean that her time wasn't also qualitative, because she was enjoying what she was doing. And it also doesn't mean that I wasn't, to be honest, sitting there thinking, I wonder when Christy's getting back, and let's see, when do we eat dinner tonight, and what are we going to have? But it's a matter of emphasis. Yeah. Now there's a sense in which quantitative time really points up our mortality, doesn't it? Because quantitative time is lost every moment. I mean, it dies. It isn't, it will never be 12 noon, the 13th of September, 1994, again. I mean, that was it, folks. It's all over. Whatever was true then, it's gone. It's goodbye. That's gone. But qualitative time is, in a sense, if not eternal, it's sort of timeless, isn't it? you can even call it, recall it. I mean, I can think now of when I was sitting there and the rain was coming down, I was in the chair, here are the trees, and I can almost, well, I can't really know when I can relive that again, but that's true qualitative science. In a sense, that's almost what some theologians have called an eternal now. It's, you're fully in the now, or what's the phrase, and you're resting in the real. Have you discovered, as you've moved into the later, what they call the later years, the more fully developed years, you move to that, have you discovered that the time has taken on more of a qualitative air to it? That is, can you give an example if that's the case? Anybody? Yeah?
I heard a woman older than I say, the war really affected my family. I had no idea what war she was talking about. And, you know, we do say that a lot.
Yeah,
well, it turned out
that
she was a black lady whose family, after the Civil War, was greatly affected.
That was the war. Yes, that's interesting.
She had lived through the Civil War.
Oh,
well, she had lived through the effects of it on her family.
The war is World War II in my generation.
Right.
You know, that's the war before the war, after the war, right? It's World War II. It's not the Vietnam War. Well, qualitative time. Can you give an example? I gave the example from Glacier Park. What example would you give in your life? I'll wait.
Well, is this along the lines of listening to, say, a recording of some good music?
Sure.
Very meditative.
Yeah.
Especially if it's familiar and delightful.
When I first was really grabbed by the Holy Spirit, as I think of it, as it happened, those next years I was just consumed with interest in theology. I just read one book after another. And that is a very precious time that I recall.
Of
his qualitative time.
Taking in the new thoughts and so forth.
Yeah. That was really, you know, on my mind almost all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I was busy being a monk and so forth.
Yeah. Sort of adds a deeper dimension to your time, doesn't it?
It did.
Yeah. Almost what you might call in non-religious terms a substrata. That is a... yeah.
It was going on at the same time.
Exactly,
that's
sure.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it's a little like what Brother Lawrence meant by practicing the presence of God. He didn't mean that every moment of every day he thought about, oh, I'm practicing the presence of God. But rather that kind of in the back of his mind or underneath or the backdrop was always the sense of being in God's presence. And if he thought about it, then it was there, but he didn't always think, well, yeah, I've experienced that.
We drew from San Diego. Mm-hmm. Now, some of it was quantitative time. We wanted to get there.
Yeah, sure.
But some was qualitative because we saw some beautiful things.
yeah.
The redwoods and, we drew up Columbia River and came, it was raining. But we saw the waterfalls, we saw two rainbows at one time, which I didn't know was possible.
Yeah, I've seen that.
I think that's quality.
Yeah, that is, in fact, that's a real rare gift. We, for the first time in our lives now, we live in a place, we're up on a hill, we live in a place where we can see the whole rainbow.
Oh, then that
and if it's a double rainbow, we can see the whole thing.
It was bright.
I've always lived in places where you never saw the whole thing.
Yeah.
They have a lot in common. See, when I get older, I'll wear purple. When does time drag for you?
When you can't sleep.
Not a bad example. Okay. We can identify with that. What's another time when time drags for you?
When you're waiting for something.
Or someone. Impatient. Yes. The impatience of Joe is generous. Okay. When does time fly?
When you're busy.
When I'm busy.
Doing what you like.
Doing something, yeah.
Particularly if you're doing what you like.
Yeah, particularly.
What is that?
Reading a good book.
Reading a good book, yeah. Time flies. Right? Any other time when that happens? Or any other? When you're really fully involved in something, is when time flies, doesn't it?
Right. When you're trying to finish a book or something and you know that you have to stop at a particular
time. Time flies then. I see. Okay. All right. When do you lose all track of time? You have experiences where you're just almost not aware.
The same.
Exactly when you're immersed in something that really just...
something else.
Requires your whole.
When does that happen? Recently?
Well, when I'm immersed in something that I'm really enjoying doing, I lose all track of time. It may be with my grandchildren, if I'm enjoying my grandchildren, either playing with them or watching with them or trying to play with them or to keep up with them. I enjoy that. I enjoy to see how the children are beginning to take on new characteristics as they grow. You can see their growth as you go on.
Well, yeah.
And you just forget. You don't think about the time. I'm surprised sometimes I spend an afternoon with them at a supper time or dinner time. Felt like we just got through with the lunch.
Yeah. And it feels good.
It really does.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's an incredible amount you can learn from children, particularly young children, about how to immerse yourself in their lives because they are so immersed.
Yeah.
And I watch the kids out here. They're just, they're involved. Nothing else is going on. They're involved, even if they're in the worship service. Nothing else is going on. How does this phrase get to you? Because it's an image that has helped me. The idea of savoring time. Does that say anything? To savor time.
Keep it.
Taste it. Savor, of course, is more than taste.
Thoroughly enjoying.
Yeah.
To be immersed in something and enjoy it so much that you just love that experience.
That you're not looking forward to what's next.
That's right.
It's so involved in what it is.
Do you think you can do that better when the pressure is off to succeed or to achieve or to move from one thing to the next? That is more our time of life, in other words. Do you think you can do that more at this stage? Savor, savor, John.
I think being at Holden is a way to save her because we can't get out of here till the
Friday.
And realize there's no pressure.
Yeah. I mean, we're not going to leave till that's it. Yeah.
And we don't have to sit in this lecture if we don't want to.
It has to be a conscious thing. You have to be aware.
Savor, yes, right. I'm glad you picked that up because in the image of savor, it is conscious. It's willful. It's not just letting it happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it has to be without the pressure.
Well, without pressure. Yeah. Not savor, not conscious in the sense of compulsive, then, is what you want to say, I think.
Yeah. Awareness.
Awareness.
Enjoying what you're doing.
Have you been struck as I have? Oh, man, I don't quite know all the words for this, but it's like if you're standing, let's say, up in one of these chalets, they're called, aren't they? Yeah, chalets, and you're on the porch there, and you look out over this whole area, which is absolutely gorgeous view. That you feel a sort of an overload. That is that there's so much there. You feel a little guilty if you turn away. You know, because it's so beautiful. Do you connect with that at all? And yet, you can't take it all in. But you sort of want to take it all in. Want to savor it. Really enjoy it, but then you feel like, well, I can't just sit here forever and take all this in just now, you know, continually. And yet, you can't. I know when I travel overseas, for example, I'll think about the tour and I'll think, did I really see those things? Because there was so much there.
Aren't pictures a blessing?
Oh, thank God, yes, right. Or journals. You know, I keep a diary now, so I can go back and Lori and I will, at night I'll write down what happened that day, and then I'll say, now on this date a month ago, let's look at what happened then, and this date a month before that, let's look at what happened. And you can sort of relive and savor, re-savor.
But if you do the pro golf type journal,
yeah.
You put down your feelings at that time.
Yeah.
That's a great thing to look at.
I used to do some of that. Yeah, that is. Do you do that at all?
I have done it. I don't do it regularly. Yeah. Now.
Well, you don't have to.
No. But, you know, coming up here since 77, as I have, and looking and having hiked to all of these places, I don't have to do that anymore. I can just look up at Copper Basin. I know what's up there.
I know what's up there. I know what that looks like. I'll have to take that hike to find out. You know?
I know how hard it is.
But the savoring of time, I don't know, that's just, I want to throw it out to you. That's, you're right, that has to be intentional. It is a willful thing. It's not quite the same as what you were saying, Ken, about where you just lose all track of time and you're totally immersed. It's not quite that, is it? It's a little more conscious.
Appreciation of it.
Appreciation, yeah. That's what I'm talking about, but not, I don't want to think of it as compulsive. It's something I'm learning, how to savor time. And I think part of the reason is, connected with mortality, is that it sort of takes some of the sting out of the mortality. That is, it takes some of the sting out of the fact that time is going to go. And that I never will live another day again. So to fully live in the time, to rest in the real, as Kathleen Fisher said, is a way of in a sense, it's a way of pushing off mortality. I mean, you know, it's a way of, you know, of saying, but we can fully live now. We don't have to worry about, will I die tomorrow or will I die in 20 years or 30 years or whatever.
Well, it's related to enjoying life. And
sure, sure. Yeah.
It's the opposite of my last parish. Had a man who was retired by his company.
Uh-huh.
In the thorn of flesh, and he wasn't prepared for retirement.
How old was he?
When he was retired, 63.
Uh-huh.
And he was getting retired, 65, with his wonderful mother. You're retired now.
Yeah.
And he simply dropped out of everything. He stopped going to town. He was about half a mile out of town. Stopped coming to church.
Oh.
And I talked to him about his little pastor. You've got to remember, I'm an old man.
Hmm. Oh, God. 63. Mercy.
What's the statistics of the retirees who have nothing to plan for
and
in
die
the first
for
year?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Die, life is over.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I've had friends who said to me, I can't retire, I don't know what I do. I go crazy. Boy, it's pretty sad, but they're probably right. That's what they say, they're probably correct. I want to move now a little bit into the second area, because this also deals with mortality, health and illness. And I need to tell you that I'm an evangelist on this one. If you don't buy it, it's okay, but I'm not that kind of evangelist, but I'm an evangelist in the sense that I think our culture has led us down a primrose path on this, in this area. Do you think of perfect health as the normal thing? That perfect health is normal and illness is abnormal? That's a question I think we have to ask to ourselves. I read a book many years ago by a man by the name of Rene DeBolo called The Mirage of Health. And like a lot of books, like a few books, that affect you, you know, in ways that, that was one of them. He pointed out that we have bought into the idea that health is the norm. And if we aren't really incredibly healthy, we've been cheated. And his point was that really illness, not, you know, way down deep by dying next week, illness necessarily, but some form of disease or of illness, to use a better another term, is much more the norm. And I remember I taught a course one time at a seminary in Berkeley on, and I suggested to the class, I said that most all of us are chronically ill. Not terminally ill, except we're all mortal, but chronically ill. There's something probably that we're taking medication for. When I was growing up, they used to call this, so-and-so is under a doctor's care. Remember that phrase? I've been under a doctor's care for a long time, I tell you. Laurie's under a doctor's care. More than one, right? I mean, you know, we have more than one doctor now. And I used to think, well, something's wrong here. You know, I mean, you shouldn't have to take pills for things. I mean, we should really be very, very healthy. And the business about, well, you know, if you have your health, you have everything. Right? You know, if you have your health, you have everything. Well, I don't know. I know a lot of unhealthy people have a lot more than some people who are healthy. I've had high blood pressure since I was 40. That's 22 years. I don't want to name you all the other stuff I have, but there's a few other things that are piling up there. And so I'm really chronically ill. I don't mean I go around feeling morose about it, but that I such that I'm chronically ill. And I would guess that the majority of people in this room probably are medicating for something on a regular basis, so there's a sense in which you're chronically ill. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but I think our culture has sort of put such a, hasn't it? Has put such a premium on health. I see these people, and it just kills me. I realize I'm overweight, but I see these people thin. My Lord, they're thin. Running. You know, I mean, just, they run how many miles a day? My Lord, you know, you're going to get an absolutely nothing if you do that. I don't run, but my doctor would probably tell me if you ran, you'd be crazy in the head. Yeah.
I tell you, with that health as a norm, we're all chronically battling illness.
Good point, yeah. We are, yeah.
Even the runners, why are they doing it? Gotta get my cardiovascular system in good shape and keep it there.
Yeah.
To stay well.
It's almost become, among a certain generation, not ours, but it's become a kind of a religion, I've noticed. have you noticed that? It's become a sort of
health cults.
Religion substitute. Religion substitute. Yeah, it's sort of the anorexia generation.
But quite a few people get up early on Sunday morning and they're out there running.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they do for their worship.
I
forgot what I wanted to say, sorry.
None of us have ever experienced that.
No, I know. First time it happened.
Yeah.
I just about to say that. For some people, there ought to be more concern for the slobs that they are.
Of course. I would agree. Okay. And I'd rather you hadn't looked at me when you said that.
He didn't mean to look at
you. I'm kidding. at what point would you be in your eyes now, not in the eyes of others, at what point would you be in your eyes too ill? What would you have to be too ill? Maybe you never. Can't function the way you'd like to. Have you functioned the way you'd like to for the last 30 years?
A lot of the time.
Good. Okay.
Not the last year.
Can't function the way you like to. All right, but that's a good definition.
But I think that not mentally being able to be with it and to handle some decision making of some sort.
That would be too ill. Yeah. To be mentally not with it. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? What would be your definition of it? To me, this would be too ill.
Well, like Marthea's, only I put it differently, just not to be able to do the things that you really want to do that day or that period of your life.
Uh-huh. Or is it not being able to do the things you think you ought to be able to do? Because isn't what really happens is that if you get to the place where you can't do the things you want to do, you change your ideas of what you want to do.
Well, your mental attitude has so much to do with your health. And I think to lose that control over your mental health to keep your attitude right.
Is that the big fear? In an era of all Alzheimer's, for example, is the biggest fear you have, I'll say this for you, I say this, us is the biggest fear we have, the fear of losing it up here?
Yes.
That I can tolerate almost anything else except losing it here.
Most people aren't happy.
But
maybe.
Which is interesting, but yesterday in our class, one of the fellows in the class has Alzheimer's, at least he has the indications. So if you remember when he was trying to say something, it didn't make sense in one sense, but and And I think we, most of us, find that extremely threatening, not because of that person so much, but because, will I be there?
Yeah.
As I said to Laurie, you know, if I ever get to that point, shoot me. Now, she'd be in real trouble if she did, but...
My wife plays for a rest home every Wednesday afternoon, and just to see the patients there and the state in which they are, all kinds of weird conduct.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't go into a description, but I'm sure you're all aware of that. That, to me, would be, oh, no, Lord, keep me out of this place, or this situation.
Right, right. Or at least if I am, don't make me a burden on those who love me. You know, let me...
Maybe have a home like that waiting for me if I need it.
Whatever, yeah.
I think the point was made before that people in that situation are not burdened by where they, you know, they're not with it. They're in their own little world. My experience was that they were not suffering themselves because of it.
But the people around them saw.
People around them, yeah. And so it came out with a case of question in the earlier session with Joe. You know, why?
Why? Feel that way? Yeah, right, right. Somebody over here.
Well, it just seems to me in some of these nursing home situations, I hear the people who are always calling, I need the nurse. She doesn't need the nurse, but that person can't be. Happy and relaxed and peaceful.
Yeah,
so I don't think that it's true of all of them.
There's one fellow that goes around here constantly and wipes off the dust of all the rails. All the rails. He gets all done, he does it all over again. Oh dear. Wonder what he thinks.
Yeah, yeah, right.
He's worried about dirt, I guess, or dust or something.
And just the opposite. I was thinking about all these people that are handicapped. In a wheelchair race and playing basketball and everything,
yeah,
and
yeah.
They don't let it get them.
But mentally, they're still with it.
They're with it. Yeah. They're just as capable.
Sure.
Happy as most of us who have completed.
Right, right. I think people come to terms with that. That is more and more as I see that. We read an article the other day in some magazine, which talked about a number of deaf people today. Are proud of the fact that they're deaf, rejoice in the fact they're deaf, don't want to be other than deaf. You know, really interesting kind of phenomenon, sort of, I'm deaf and I'm proud. Now that doesn't mean that everybody who's deaf is that way, but that means that there are some who are. But mentally, you see, they're still clicking and working. At what point would someone whom you love be too ill? I don't know about yourself now, but when would you say they're just too ill?
Well, when they needed machines to keep them functioning.
Okay, yeah. We faced that with my dad. Basically, we let him go. I mean, you know, we didn't kill him, but he was 90 years old, but he just wasn't functioning. We let him go.
So many times, families too, try to prolong the life of that one who is ill. Don't leave him now, you know. And I know two cases that the family really got up and said, we're allowing you to die, Dad.
Give you permission.
Yes.
Yeah. Writing a living will makes sense.
Oh, boy. I tell you. Yeah, we just went through the business of healthcare proxy. And decided who we wanted to make those decisions, and either one or both of us got to that place. You know, I had to think that through a while before. Not in terms of who it was, because that wasn't a problem, but the thing I had to think through was, this is kind of a step, isn't it? I mean, I reacted against that for about a year. Laurie, who's worked with older people all her professional life, has been pushing me on this for how long? And finally I said, well, yeah, I guess we ought to do that. Living will was okay, but the healthcare proxy in the state of Washington, you know, you say, this is what I don't want, this is what I'll tolerate, and these are the persons who will make the decision.
I've got that all stuff. I keep putting it off. You know, I don't feel the least bit near.
Yeah. Me either.
And
yeah.
So it seems.
I know.
Lots of time, and I know that is.
Right. Most people don't. The majority of people don't even have wills, you know, let alone living wills.
Well, to add one other factor,
yeah.
I think the other dread would be if we completely ran out of cash. We couldn't afford
it. Yes,
couldn't
that's
afford
right.
to survive.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to deal with that issue. I guess it's tomorrow on Monday. But, yeah. Because then you would feel totally dependent for one thing. And you
on a burden.
On a burden.
Family, if there
that's
is
right. That's right. Yeah.
Present cost, that could happen real fast.
Not well, very rapidly. Now let's pursue this a little bit more. Since it's probably true, at least I think it's true, that the majority of people are really ill one way or another. What would happen if in our society, we sort of turned that around then and said, well, illness is really more normal, and perfect health is an illusion? Suppose we said that, and suppose we believed it, would there be any changes in the way we looked at things?
We wouldn't always feel apologetic when we're sick.
That would help a lot, wouldn't it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. We really do feel guilty for being
or
sick.
Angry.
Mm-hmm.
Or what?
Angry.
Angry.
Yeah.
Why do we feel guilty for being sick?
Isn't it funny? We feel as though we ought to be well. We do, isn't it? I've never thought of that before.
Well, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Haven't you ever felt guilty for being sick?
Our self-image is all tied up in this thing.
Being healthy.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, our self-image goes down.
And we're a burden to somebody very often.
And you probably are.
Yeah.
It's probably accurate. Yeah, right. And you're not totally independent.
No.
You know, maybe somebody has to remind you to do something or other. Have you taken your pill today, dear? No. Or, let me worry about that. Okay. But I have to deal with the consequences if you don't.
Or you can't drive a car.
Yeah.
Right. You know, or there may be a number of things you can't. Okay. Not feeling so guilty about it. That would be a big step forward, wouldn't it?
Would.
That would be a major sea change in the way we look at things in the American culture.
Wouldn't that be doubly true if you made yourself ill over something?
Then really, yeah, talk about double whammy.
Just overdid, you know.
In terms of guilt, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you could trace your illness to something you did, it's even worse.
Oh,
right. But that's a tricky thing, though, because I remember the last time I sprained my ankle, which is a few years ago now, and I just said, well, that was dumb. Right? I mean, you know, that was really dumb. Well, but people sprain their ankles who are perfectly intelligent. I mean, you can miss a step, you know, but you sort of assume, I should be in control every moment of every day, so that I will never twist my ankle, I will never have a headache, because I will say to myself, I will not have a headache. I will not have high blood pressure because I will exercise regularly and I will eat exactly what I should. And the fact that my father had high blood pressure at the same age is totally irrelevant because I can make up for that. You know, all this stuff goes through our head. That we can atone for not only our sins, but everybody else's sins, our father's sins, our mother's sins. And that we won't suffer from this. Or some of us, I think, I know that Lori was to a degree, some of us are programmed as when we were younger of it's really, you shouldn't take a pill.
Oh, sure.
That's a sign of weakness. Right, Lori? Yeah. My mother was exactly the opposite. She took a pill for everything. She was totally different. You know, if you felt the least little bit, would you like an aspirin, dear? Or would you like some? Yeah, she's a bit of a hypochondriac, but she's 91 going on 92, you know, so, and Dad died at 90, and I mean, it's, she may have been right. She was aware of illness. She had not bought into the thing that perfect health was the top deal, which is, well, think about that. Yeah, okay, I wanted to look at this quote. I knew there was a head down here to look at this quote. The one that starts, "It's not death I fear." "It's not death I fear," a man in his 70s told me. "It's all that I might have to go through before it comes." Death is the final moment of life, the end of life as we know it. Dying, on the other hand, is the journey a person must take in the last phase of life. It is the process leading to the end, and for older persons, it can sometimes be a long journey of progressive suffering on many levels. They often fear weakness, pain, physical dependence, and mental deterioration more than a cessation of life. I think that's true.
Sure.
Death itself is then longed for as a release from a dying process that seems endless and senseless. Well, that may be going a bit far, but it's not going too far for some folks. I identified with that phrase. It's not death I fear, it's all I might have to go through before it comes. It's dying I don't like. death, but dying. Or the dying of those who are close to me. I mean, Lord, you know, that, and many of you have experienced that, of the dying of those particular.
That's a blessing.
That it's a blessing
sometimes
if they're released.
It's a blessing. After a lot of pain.
Let's move on now to this matter of life after death. It seems to me that there are basically three attitudes one can take toward the possibility of life after death. One is, we die and that's it. And therefore, immortality is not life after death. Immortality is the immortality of memory. That is that. And this is, to quite an extent, what was true of the Old Testament understanding, that that you live on in memory. And I think, you know, this, whatever you believe about life after death, that's true. I was very close to my grandfather, and I can bring Granddad back any day I want, any moment I want, and be in his presence again. I mean, that's the thing you can do in memory. I mean, in a sense, my grandfather's not dead. He is, literally. But not in my memory, right? Or the same way with anyone who's close to me. But death is death. Second possibility is you die and then you're absorbed or reabsorbed into God, let's say, or into the One. But you don't have individual identity. That is, you're taken up into, or not up necessarily, but you're, this is often true, for example, some Hindu and Buddhist thinking particularly, where you're they would call reabsorbed into the One. That's a little bit like, though this is not quite that, the quote at the bottom from Dan O'Hanlon, whom I knew, he's dead now, by the way. Dan was a Jesuit professor at Jesuit School of Theology in Berkeley, and a student of Buddhism, interestingly enough, so I think that affects some of what he says here. "I do not think so much of afterlife as a time. I think of the reality of God as a present reality and as an abiding reality, and if my connection with that is something that is basic and will remain." Interesting way to put it, isn't it? "I think reality not as a place, but as a way of being. I do not have particular images of it." In other words, he's not thinking is heaven paved with gold. "There is the sense of that deep part of my being which is in touch with the deep reality of the divine, and there's no reason why that should cease to be just because my body wears out." That's an interesting way to put it. In a way, that's sort of saying, my soul goes on, my body's gone. But it's also the sense of being somehow connected with that which is eternal. And I don't think O'Hanlon really worried particularly about what form that takes after death, as he believed that, that really wasn't necessary to even worry about that. But that he couldn't believe somehow that this connection with God would stop at death. But he didn't need to be specific as to what the connection would feel like after death. It's interesting. Then the third possibility, of course, and the more common one, that we die enter into a new dimension of life with some form of individual identity. This is, of course, I don't know how worried you are about this, but I'm a student of Eastern religions. Well, you wouldn't know that, but anyway. Eastern, and much of Eastern thought, they've wrestled with this question of, is there a personal identity after death, or is there not? I think in Western thinking, we have generally assumed that there is a personal identity. That is, that you would sort of know you were there, one may put it rather crassly, and that you'd be aware. St. Paul, if you'll remember, wrestled with this. He said, and this is paraphrasing, he said, well, we have a body, no, it's not like our body, but it's a spiritual body, because he couldn't figure out how to talk about it. And he says, it's a spiritual body, but of course, knowing Paul, he would write one letter and he'd think about one letter and write another letter, he'd have some other conclusions. And the gospel writers, I think, they had trouble with this because the received tradition was, I remember all these gospels were written much later, but the received tradition was that Jesus had somehow conquered death and that folks had experienced his presence after the crucifixion. But it wasn't always clear to the gospel writers how that took place or how specific that was. And Bishop Spong, who's a very interesting writer, Episcopal bishop, has written a book called Resurrection, where he thinks that the basic resurrection experience of the disciples was a vision of Christ sitting on the right hand of God the Father in heaven. And he thinks that was the basic vision, which is interesting. It's not true in the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, where there's emphasis, on actual physical contact. But I don't think we can say that there's one Christian view of even or one biblical view of life after death. There's a lot of speculation in that. Generally speaking, it's true they always believe that God is eternal. But whether we are eternal in that sense, or whether we're aware of ourselves, we don't know. But I've been fascinated by this near-death stuff. Have you followed any of that? Mm-hmm. What I've been fascinated by is not just the description of the experience. What I've been fascinated by is the leaps of faith people have come to after it. That is, when they say, well, you see, this proves life after death, and it proves that it's positive, because it's warm and there's light. Now that's overdoing it, and therefore it's going to be that way. There's going to be a tunnel and you're going to see all the people you...